back, pulls up the three, boom, knocks it down. Curry from the corner at three, puts it in.
For overtime, makes it, Garrett, Murray.
Welcome to this edition of the MVP Cast. I'm your host, Mark Woods. My guest this time around is a BBL veteran in the truest sense of the word. A decade now he's been playing at one team. He had dark hair when he started, grey now, but still going very strong. And he's also got a parallel career on the go, which has him back of house as well as front and centre on the court. He is, of course, Sheffield Sharks forward Mike Tuck. Mike, thanks for joining us on the MVP Cast.
Thank you very much for having me. And also, thank you for taking a shot at my hair color already. This early into the podcast.
You're just a little bit ahead of me, but not very much. I'm right behind you. So we're
thanks for reminding
I share your pain. Let's talk a way back to when, before you even had hair, you know, before it was still growing. You're born and raised in Toronto. And that was a time when we were just starting to see that Canadian basketball was about more than that young fella called Steve Nash at the time. I mean, now that we've seen the explosion, describe the environment that was in place at that time for young players such as yourself coming through.
Well, I mean, yeah, this was like, you know, I was born in 83 and I ended up at high school in 97. And, you know, Canada has always been known as the hockey country. We've always produced, you know, the best hockey players and the best hockey teams in the world. And back in the mid 90s, basketball was a popular sport, but it was still a very much growing sport. And I think, you know, I think something happened in Toronto in the mid 90s, and it was the Toronto Raptors. So the NBA came to Toronto in 1995. And I think that really pushed along the basketball wave throughout the city. I think it was probably like the generation before me and my generation of high school players. That's when everything really, really started to take off. And then after that, basketball, you know, really grew with popularity. I think, you know, it was a number of things that helped that along. Obviously, when the Toronto Raptors came in, their first few seasons they weren't that great, and then, you know, they signed Tracy McGrady and Vince Carter, two of the most high flying and exciting, you know, basketball players to watch, and I think that drew a lot of attention. It was also kind of like the and one era, so everybody was looking for that type of a guy who had handles, could jump really high, and exciting guys to watch like that, almost like a street baller but in the NBA. So that really drew a lot of attention to the Toronto Raptors, and there's a great documentary that's out on Netflix now called The Carter Effect, and it kind of goes over all those things that were happening in Toronto, you know, at the turn of the century there, and how it all, you know, you fast forward 18 years later from, you know, the year 2000 to now, and like the two of the last top draft picks have been kids from Toronto, and so you can see it had that trickle down effect, and, you know, almost 20 years later, here we have, you know, the NBA is seeing an explosion of Canadian players. We have the most amount of international on the scene, international scene. The Canadians are the second most after the Americans in the NBA. So it was really cool to see. And it was also a cool thing to be a part of, you know. I was the pre, you know, YouTube generation. But as soon as YouTube came around and everything, that's when, you know, all the Canadian players started getting a lot more exposure. You know, coaches didn't actually have to fly up or drive up to north of the border to go see guys. And they, you know, this hotbed of basketball players was kind of exposed. And then Toronto in general is just, it's a massive city. It's a huge market. It's extremely international. Lots of African, Caribbean, European kids there, so, you know, it's a perfect place for basketball to grow, because you have all these this international community there, that most of them coming from countries that already love basketball. So it was a very cool thing to be a part of, and, you know, I'm very proud to be from Toronto.
I mean, if you get development, and obviously the system there for hockey is so well established, and, you know, Pee Wee hockey and kids coming through, and you play high school teams, etc., and then you go to the pros. Your development system when you were growing up, what was the what was the kind of magic touch maybe that was within that that sent guys to the very top, sent guys like you to Europe and overseas and continues to turn out really strong talent?
Well, definitely in my case, everything for me goes to my high school coach, George Krause. I played at a kind of mini regional tournament when I was about, I was probably about 11 or 12 years old. And, his son was the same year as me, and he was a phys ed teacher at a local high school. So he kind of recruited me from a very young age, and, ended up going to the same high school as his son. And he recruited a few other kids from outside our area, and we ended up having a very good high school team, which won a lot of our regional tournaments and you know, the regional championships and stuff like that. So that really helped spurred me on to go to the States. You know, he was the one who kind of put the idea, like, okay, you can, you know, you could get a free education from this. You can go down to the States, get a scholarship, and then potentially you could keep playing after that. And also with the fact that my mother was born, in England, I had the European or the GB passport. So, that was kind of implanted in my brain at a very young age. I think now the high school system in Canada is the same, but much more sophisticated and better now, whereas they have a lot of prep school programs there where it's basketball programs that are completely dedicated to basketball. And they're recruiting kids from all over the world to come to these schools. And you're seeing a lot of these kids, especially, you know, NBA kids that have gone to prep school programs in Toronto and done it that way.
I mean, you had that year at high school, but it's effectively a prep school in Maine. And you see now that those Canadian teams, their AAU teams come down from Canada, play in the States. And you end up though getting a scholarship to Loyola University in Maryland. Was that really past that point where there was that resistance to Canadian talent that maybe there'd been in the past?
I think at that time, yeah, I think a lot of schools were wary of Canadian players. They didn't know much about Canadian players. There was like a kind of a stigma that Canadian players were soft. So that's what it made it really hard for me to get recruited right out of Canadian high school. I did have a few schools on me, but mostly Division II schools. So when I did that 1 year of prep school in America, my exposure blew up because, you know, here I am at a American prep school, and we were playing in the NEPSAC, which that the year I was there was considered the best prep school league in the country. So we were playing against, you know, all types of kids that were going to you know, Division I, high, mid-major Division I schools. I think we had 11 players on our team, and 10 of them ended up getting scholarships. So that really helped me out. And, you know, Loyola was I had a few offers, but I took a trip down to Loyola, Maryland, and fell in love with the campus, fell in love with the gym and the program. And, you know, I had an opportunity there to play right away and get good minutes in my freshman year. So it was a great choice for me. And I, you know, really happy that I went there.
Having the European passport, of course, opened up many, many doors for you. Before you came to Sheffield, there was a life. There was a Mike Tuck playing professionally before that people kind of forget. You had two clubs in Cyprus, if I recall, Luxembourg and France as well. You come out of Canada, you come out of college in the US. What's it like when someone goes, come and play in a foreign country, language a bit different, culture a bit different?
Yeah, well, that was, it was exciting, but also, you know, extremely scary at the same time. I obviously had made the move from Canada to the US, so that was, you know, already a bit of a culture shock, but obviously nothing compared to the culture shock that was ahead of me, you know, coming over to Europe. My first year in Cyprus was extremely, not challenging, but it was just a very, very different, and it was an adjustment for me to make. You know, lived in Nicosia in the major city. So thankfully there was a lot of people there that spoke English, and most of my teammates spoke English. But, you know, there would be times when, you know, you'd go into a restaurant or go to a store and you'd be trying to buy something, and they don't speak English. So you got to make an effort and speak, try and, you know, do sign language and speak the little bit of language that you do know. And it was a huge culture shock, but it was great. it was something that I'll never forget, and get all these different countries I've lived in. You know, I've lived in six different countries over my years. So it's been great. I really will cherish, you know, these years playing professional basketball. And any young guy that's in university right now that's looking to go pro, I would definitely, you know, suggest it for them. And, you know, throw yourself out there and go explore the world and see new places.
You're in a place that they don't speak the language. What's the stickiest moment that you can recall being involved in?
Well, I lived in, when I lived in Cyprus, I lived in Nicosia, and we lived on, obviously, the southern side, the Greek side. Cyprus, for people who don't know, is still a country that's kind of at conflict. So there's a conflict between the Turkish, who are on the north side of the island, and the Greeks, who are on the south side of the island. And the island is split in two by it's called the Green Line. And, you know, the United Nations, they were driving around tanks around the city all the time. Their base was on our side. I lived in an apartment in the top floor, and we would look out, our apartment looked out onto the Turkish side, and they painted in a big Turkish flag on the side of one of the mountains there. And it's kind of like it was like a big middle finger to the Greek side. Like, I believe it was back in the 70s, the Turkish just decided that it was their island, and they came in and bombed the Nicosia airport. And ever since the 70s now, it's been at conflict. So there was one night we were in the old city, in the old town, and basically the old town is split right down the middle with this line. And we came out of a bar, and the old city, that you can't drive cars into it because the roads are so small and it's all just winding little alleyways and stuff. And we made a wrong turn down an alleyway and ended up coming on the Green Line. And there was a Turkish soldier there with an AK-47, and he actually pointed it at us. And we were like, "Ooh," put our hands up and slowly walked the other direction. Like, "Nope, sorry." So that was probably the most intense moment I've had in terms of that.
But I guess going to college in Baltimore, you're used to mean streets and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, definitely. Well, yeah, the Wire, Baltimore. Yeah, I've got lots of stories about Baltimore, but yeah, very. Baltimore can be very. It's a great city. I love it, but obviously there is a lot of violence there and a lot of gun violence there. So you wouldn't be surprised if you heard some gunshots going off at night when you're driving through the wrong neighborhood.
Well, I mean, all of us have seen The Wire. You have this image of Baltimore as gangsters in every corner, that you can't go out after dark, that it's just, you know, gunshots at dawn and dusk, etc. What was the reality for you when you look back on it there?
Loyola, Maryland is in the northern part of the city, and it's in a very nice area of the city. There's probably, you know, million-dollar homes kind of all around it. But if you drive, you know, two blocks over and you go past York Road, you're in a less fortunate area of the city. So there's not a lot of middle ground there. It's either you got a really nice big house or you have a not so nice house. That's at least when I was going to school there. Now I know now that there's been a lot of gentrification. They've made a huge effort with the downtown core, especially. But I think it's all about neighborhoods there. And you know, there's certain neighborhoods that, you know, just kind of, you got to stay out of them. And then there's other ones where they're obviously a lot nicer. And I think that's just the biggest divide there.
It's 10 years now since you rocked up in Sheffield. Sharks give you a call, give your agent a call in that summer. How does that deal come about at the time?
Well, I was playing for a team in France, in Chalon-Champagne. And the team was not doing so well. We were losing. So they had released a few guys, and then I ended up being the next guy on the list. So I was released, they were going to fly me back to Toronto while I waited for another job. But I said it was about the midway point of the season. It was about just the end of November, beginning of December. So I said there's still a lot of season left, and I'm pretty, you know, pretty confident that I'll get picked up by another team. So I said, instead of flying me back to Toronto, just fly me to England, and I can wait there while it's while I wait for a team to sign me. And I thought that might be a better deal for, you know, a European club. If they don't have to, you know, pay for a huge long flight from Canada, they can just, I'll be in London and close and on standby. So, yeah, I flew to London. I stayed at a friend's place who was living in London at the time. And I had was going through all my contacts while I was there, and I had remembered that I had gotten an email over the summer from a guy named Atiba Lyons. And at the time in the summer, I had already signed my contracts in France. So I didn't even reply to the email. And then obviously I'm in England now, I'm in London. I look at Atiba's email, and he's coaching and playing for the Sheffield Sharks. And I go onto the BBL's website and check out, and I was like, Sheffield Sharks, first place. And I was like, oh, perfect. Let me give this guy a call. So I emailed Atiba. I got an email back, and he said, you know, why don't you come up for a trial, you know, come to one of our training sessions and see how it goes. So I still remember the night. I took the train up to Sheffield and taxi right to the EIS. And I had a great practice. And then, you know, went out for dinner with Atiba after, and the next day they offered me a contract, and I've literally been here ever since. So, yeah, it was kind of crazy. And it's one of those things in your life where, you know, everything kind of happens for a reason. And, you know, if I had never gotten released by that team in France and decided to stay in London, then I probably would have never ended up here. So it's just kind of crazy way to end up here. And I never thought that I would be here for this long. Like, I was kind of thinking, you know, one and done, I'll finish out the season in Sheffield, and then I'll move on and get back to Europe. But, you know, as soon as I got here, they were already in the semifinals of the cup. We won the semifinals. I had a really good game. And then we went on to the finals of the cup, and that was at the end of January, and we won those as well. So, you know, we had won a cup. We were first place in the league. We ended up getting knocked out in the semifinals that season. So we missed the playoffs, and we had already knocked out of the trophy. So, but I had been there for like maybe 2 months, and I had already won a cup. And I was like, I could get used to this. You know, I got a taste for silverware. So when they offered me to come back the next season, it was a pretty easy yes for me. And then the next season, again, we ended up winning the cup again. So we won back-to-back cups. And from there, I was pretty much hooked on getting silverware. And I thought Sheffield would be the best place for me to do that. So fast forward, you know, 10 years, and I'm still here and still fighting for silverware.
What's the closest you've ever come in any off-season to leaving and moving somewhere else, or come back to the day job, or come back to Canada?
There was probably, let me think. It was probably the 2014-15 season, or yeah, 14-15. I was in the back of my head, I was like, okay, is this for me? Do I want to keep going? My contract was up, and then they offered me a 3-year extension, and then they also talked about, you know, perhaps placing me in a job placement outside of basketball so that I could start building up a career, you know, a secondary career, so that I have something else to fall back on when I do finish playing. So that was probably the one time that I was thinking, okay, maybe it's time for me to move on, or, you know, find another club or start thinking about my future and get into like a normal job. But they made that deal with me, and then I ended up working for one of our sponsors, which is a law firm called Wasco Brown. And I'd studied marketing at university. So they took me on in a marketing role there. And I worked there for 3 years, and which was perfect for me. The relationship in terms of, you know, them being a sponsor and then giving me a chance to learn and grow and help them on the marketing side was pretty much perfect. They were stepping in as a sponsor, and in the negotiation meeting for sponsorship, it came up that they had just fired their marketing manager, and they were like, oh, wow, well, we have Mike who studied marketing at university. So it was just, it all came together. Another one of those moments in my life where it's just everything was happening for a reason.
You're not obviously the marketing and commercial manager for the Sharks, but let me just touch on that law firm. You're coming into as a player, having played for a decade, and there's someone plunks you in a completely different industry. How useful was that to not kind of take a front office job, if we can call it that way, and do something in a totally different sector, but it uses that degree that you gained?
Yeah, it was huge. I think because it took me outside of my comfort zone. Whereas if I had just gone right into working for the Sharks in the front office, I don't think I would have, you know, I would have been very comfortable. I'd spent a lot of time in the office anyways, and I knew everybody in the office. Whereas this, going to work there, I didn't know anybody there. I had to wear a suit every day, which is something that I had never done before. And I was forced to obviously, you know, meet a lot of new people, and not only people at the company, but people outside the company and people in the city and in the business community of Sheffield and South Yorkshire. So it was great. It was a great learning experience for me, and it helped me build up my network, and I met all types of different people and different businesses, which in turn helped me, you know, these years later while I'm with the Sharks. So it was a great experience. And, you know, big shout out to Wasco Brown and the Brown family for having me. I always look back fondly on those days at Wasco Brown.
Having been the Sharks marketing chief now for a couple of years, what would you say at this point, from everything you've seen, what's the key thing for a BBL team in a market like this where sponsorship money, commercial money is tough to get? What's the key thing that you've had to do and teams need to do?
I think the biggest thing is growing your following. I think once clubs in this league all grow their followings more, it's obviously going to draw more attention to the league. And I think that's something that businesses these days are looking for, you know, especially younger businesses are looking for that. How is this going to impact me digitally? And, you know, how am I going to create leads out of this or brand awareness out of this partnership? And I think, you know, there's quite a few teams in this league that are doing a great job of it. And I think right now teams need to put aside a budget for marketing and pump as much into it as they can, because they're going to get reap the rewards later on down the road.
Where have you looked for ideas? I mean, because everyone goes to the NBA, but also that's a very different scale. But where have you kind of gone, that's kind of useful, I can pinch that? Or who have you spoken to that has maybe given you ideas and leads?
Well, I think the great thing about the BBL is that a lot of guys around the league don't hold stuff, you know, close to their chest. You know, you can reach out to different guys in the league who have a lot of experience with this stuff, and they'll be willing to help you out. Guys like Joel Osborne from Bristol.
And, social media king.
Yeah, he's good at what he does. And Joe Pinchin from Leicester Riders. You know, I think those two guys are really good with their clubs, obviously, but then also with helping people out. You know, they're always willing to answer any questions or lend a hand where they can. For me, for influences, I mean, obviously the NBA is a much bigger market, but, you know, that's where the BBL is. You know, every league in the world is probably trying to be like that league. So I always try and look at what clubs over there are doing. I look at what other teams around the league or our league are doing, but I always look at what clubs over in the NBA are doing. Specifically, the Toronto Raptors, they have a very good media team there. And I really like the way that they do things. So I'm always checking out their social media accounts.
I know the BBL had a seminar or away day a couple of weeks ago, and the topic was fan engagement and digital. I know you weren't able to go to it, but when you look around this league at the growth stage that it's at now, and it has been growing, but what do you think it still needs to do to make that next leap into the, you know, public consciousness, into getting sponsors and backers, etc.?
Yeah, well, I think not everybody knows, but the league has been making, you know, a big effort to help out the clubs throughout the league. And I think holding days like that is crucial for, you know, just passing along information that, and having, you know, these tutorial days is great for the guys around the league. I think if the league wants to make a huge jump for sponsorship, you know, we've got to be in the public eye. And I think signing a TV contract is the first step. And I know just saying that is one thing, and actually getting it done is another. But if you look at like the rugby leagues, I know about 15, 20 years ago, they weren't really doing so well. And then they both signed TV contracts. And, you know, even tonight I turned on the TV and you press the menu button, and that first 10 channels, one of those channels said rugby league championship or something like that. So that's where we need to be. If you want to get people excited about basketball, you got to get it on a major TV network, so that all eyes are on basketball, and it's generating interest, and young kids are watching it and saying, oh, what's this new sport? And that's the biggest way. And I know the league has made huge efforts, and being on BBC Sport is huge. But, you know, if I want to watch that game on TV and I have to press a red button and I have to shuffle through, you know, three different menus just to find the game, you know, it's not going to be as big of an impact as if we're seeing it on a primetime network where people can just turn on the channel and there it is. So I think that would be huge, you know. And then the other part is, I think they, you know, youth basketball is another huge thing. You know, if you want to build the next wave of fans and the next wave of players, you know, money has to be put into coaching and put into, you know, the youth clinics and the schools to get kids excited about basketball.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about that TV deal. I think last season you and I did a number of games in Free Sports, and that for me was the best TV deal for a while because it was accessible, it was great production, it was regular, you know, slots, and this year with it being more sporadic, it's just kind of harder to find the BBL.
Yeah, and I mean, and Free Sport was great, and I had a great time doing the sideline commentary with that. But at the same time, when I told a lot of my friends, oh, we're on Free Sport, most people hadn't heard of it because obviously it's still a relatively new network. And so I think, you know, if you want to get, you know, your name out there, you got to get on one of the big name and the heavy hitters. And that's just the name of the game.
Progress for Sharks. The big things, the big scheme for a number of years has been a move to their own venue at the Olympic Legacy Park, which was where the old Don Valley Stadium was. And I mean, there was a major hitch with Sheffield City Council not helping with the funding recently. I mean, what can you tell us about where that's at just now? And, you know, how much of a challenge does that not happening as quickly as the Sharks would have liked pose to what you want to do?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you as much as I know, because that's not really my part of the business. But obviously, there was a gap fund that the Sharks approached the city council with helping out with. The city council chose not to help out with that gap fund, so they've gone in a different direction. So the Sharks, we definitely have not given up on the project. The Sharks are still going full steam ahead with the new venue. It's just going to take a little bit longer time to find some more avenues to go down to make that happen. So we're still going ahead with it. It's just what's the timeline of that? Is it going to be years or 2 years? I don't know. I couldn't give you the best answer on that. But all I can say is that, you know, the Sharks are still moving forward with the new venue. I don't know when it's going to be here, but the land is there and it's been promised to the Sharks. And I'm really looking forward to stepping into that new venue and being a part of that.
Is that vital in terms of where you think this club can be, in terms of its potential, in terms of getting fans through the doors, in terms of just growing it as a business?
100%, because I think, and I mean, the EIS has been great to us over the years, but it's tough to play in somewhere that's, you know, that's not yours. And, you know, when we get shuffled around a lot and finding dates for games and trying to change dates of games can be a struggle at the EIS, because it's such a busy venue and it's a sought after place for other people to play and rent. So for us to have our own place and a place to call our own would be, you know, incredible. I think you look at, that's the model right now that teams around the league are going for. And, you know, you look at Leicester, who have already, you know, been in theirs for a couple of years, and now Newcastle just finishing theirs. And they both look like amazing venues. And you know, they went for the perfect size, and I think that's going to be something that's going to, you know, help the league grow and get better. Obviously, it's keeping the money at home. It's keeping the money in the league, and you can already tell that, like, especially with Leicester, you know, that they're going from strength to strength because they've got, you know, more cap to play with, and now, you know, some of the better British players are looking to go there and looking at these teams. So that it's the direction that every team in this league should be striving for right now, I think.
You broke your hand back in January the 28th. I'm sure you just loved remembering that date, and you had to, you know, bone to go back to that moment. But, you know, you've had surgery, and how's the recovery? Tell us what the status is.
Yeah, so we were playing Plymouth on the 28th of January, and I got knocked in the hand. I don't really know when it happened. It was just one of those things. My adrenaline was going, but I was running down the court, and I was like, oh, I think I dislocated my finger, because it just felt really weird. And subbed out of the game, and our trainer came over and started moving my hand back and forth, and I could hear it or feel it clicking inside my hand. So I broke my ring finger of my left hand, spiral fracture, clean break. I went in for surgery 2-3 days later. So they cut my hand open. I've got 2 screws in the bone there. So I'm out for 6 to 8 weeks, which has been interesting for me. Obviously, it's a challenge for me. This is the longest I've ever had to sit out from basketball. The only other time is I broke my wrist when I was in high school, right before the playoffs, 4 weeks before the playoffs. So the night before our semifinal game in the playoffs, my dad went out back and he said, we're cutting that thing off. So we cut off my cast, and I played the next day with my hand all strapped up. But other than that, yeah, this is the only other time. So, you know, I've been doing what I can. I've been, you know, still going to practices and doing what I can there. I've been doing a lot of cardio and just lifting lower body and that type of thing. But
so all the tedious stuff.
Yeah, all the fun stuff. Yeah, but I'm looking forward to getting back. Obviously, we've had a bit of a dip, so the team needs me right now. We need everything from all our guys. You know, all that we've got. You know, it's been a very up and down season for us. You know, these things happen, and it's just one of those things. And for me, it's just all about, you know, staying mentally tough and staying positive.
So it's going to be a fun end of the season, because everyone's looking at the loss column now, because that's really how you're judging it. And that scrap from probably 4 down to 10, 11 is going to be really intriguing over these last sort of 2 months of the regular season.
100%. I think it's going to be very similar to last season where, you know, yeah, like you said, that 4 or 5 spot to the 10 spot, everybody's just within, you know, 2 or 3 games of each other, which has been interesting to see over the last, you know, 2 seasons, how that's, you know, it's starting to beef out like that. You know, it's not really that top 5 versus, you know, the rest of the league. And now it's kind of, you know, all these other teams are starting to catch up, and that middle ground is getting harder and harder to fight for. So, you know, like we're 11-11 right now. We're a 500 ball club right now. I've said to the guys a couple of times, you know, nobody can take those 11 wins away from us. We've got those 11 wins. So it's all about right now is all about not giving up any more losses. And you know, the guys on our team, you know, everybody's professional. They know that, we have a lot of talent on our team. I think we've just struggled with a little bit of chemistry, and then obviously injuries and new guys coming in here and there. So, we're just trying to get back to getting balanced and finding that chemistry with each other.
Your 2-year deal runs up to the end of next season. Is that in your mind going to be the end of Mike Tuck's playing career? Million-dollar question.
I don't know yet. There's no big plans for anything. The only big plan would be for me is to have a testimonial game at the beginning of next summer. So not this summer, but the following summer, I'll probably have a big testimonial game, which would be something to look forward to. Have a bunch of guys that I've played with and guys from around the league come down to that. But beyond that, I'm not giving up any secrets just yet. You'll have to wait around and see.
Who's your must-haves for that? Who's your favorite guys that you've played with? And take off the current roster, but who's the guys you're going to go?
I knew you were going to ask me that. I knew it. I don't know yet because I've been here so long, and through the generations of players, I've been thinking about it. I'm like, Jesus, they're going to have like 20 guys on each team. Like, it's just, there's just so many guys that I've played with over the years. But definitely there'll be a good mix of veteran guys, and then guys that are in the league now. And then I want to have, you know, a stacked Sharks. There's a lot of Sharks alumni that I'd love to get back over here. You know, guys that I've, you know, import players that I played with, and then also, you know, local guys that I've played with over the years. So it'll be a healthy mix of vets and new guys.
And I'm guessing you're going to make a type of play just to make him run up and down the court.
Oh man, don't tell him that. He'll can't wait to get on that court.
I'm sure he's still got game, even having been retired from playing.
Oh yeah, well, you know, Tiba still gets in and practices with us sometimes. He gets up and down, so he can still play. He's still got a jumper. He's still tough. He's just not as bouncy or as quick as he used to be.
But none of us are. That's what
neither am I. That's exactly.
Mike, it's been a real pleasure hearing about your story. Always wishing you very best for the recovery from the hand injury and for the rest of the season. And thanks so much for your time and for joining us on this edition of the MVP Cast.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike. You can get all our previous shows at our website, mvp247.com. Just head for the podcast page, or if you've done so already, subscribe on any of your main podcast providers, or stream us to your smart speaker if you prefer. We'll have another edition of the MVP Cast soon. But for now, from me, Mark Woods, it's goodbye.